Welcome to Calibrate Conversations, a podcast about embracing God's standard for sexuality. I'm your host, Brady Cohn. Joining me today is our very special guest, Katie Faust. Formerly the picture of a peacemaking pastor's wife, Katie Faust is the founder and president of Them Before Us, a global children's rights nonprofit. Between soccer, carpool, and church duties, she's a mom on a mission against the progressive overreach, a globe-trotting speaker, handshaking policy influencer, and regular contributor to a variety of conservative outlets. Katie testifies and publishes widely on controversial topics such as men and women are different and children should not be bought and sold. She helped design the teen edition of Witherspoon Institute's Canavox, which studies sex, gender, marriage, relationships from a natural law perspective. All right. That is a mouthful, but what a wonderful bio and amazing things that you're doing. So welcome, Katie. So Katie, you live just outside Seattle. So we're practically neighbors.
That's right.
Which is awesome. So you're in the thick of living in cultural depravity, and you started this nonprofit, I think close to 10 years ago, Them Before Us, and you are advocating for children's rights. So what led you to start this nonprofit? What happened in our culture that made you say, I have to do this?
Utter rage. I got so angry at the way children were being victimized in the conversation specifically about marriage. I don't know if you lived here in 2012, but that's when things really heated up in Washington State when we were voting on this. And what I saw in terms of political tactics was people promoting gay marriage in the name of kids love having two moms and two dads. And I was like, that's a lie, because I had been working with kids at that point for 20 years in youth ministry, college ministry. I had been the assistant director of the largest Chinese adoption agency in the world. I had at that point four kids, one who was adopted and a lot of their friends in my home. I just stopped running the youth ministry at our church 2 years ago. I've got a lot of close contact with kids. And I'll tell you something that kids care about. They care about whether or not their mother and father loves them and whether or not their mother and father loves each other. And when you're talking about promoting a two mother home, you are talking about promoting a home where the child has been cut off from their father. And when you're promoting a two father home, you are talking about a home where a child has lost their mother. That is something that inflicts very often lifelong pain and hardship on a child. So I got into it because I felt like the conversation around marriage ignored children. On the left, they talked about it as a new civil right or adult validation, or used it as a metric to determine whether or not you loved your gay family and friends. And on the right, we talked about it as a matter of religious liberty. And if gay marriage was passed, then somebody might have to bake a cake or arrange flowers that they didn't want to make. And the reality was that redefining marriage, making husbands and wives optional in marriage, makes mothers and fathers optional in parenthood. But they're never optional. So I got into it as an anonymous blogger because I was angry that the rights of children in matters of marriage and family were not being represented, and very quickly realized that it wasn't just marriage that was obsessively focused on adults. It was everything. It was divorce, cohabitation, reproductive technologies, who gets to adopt, who goes on a birth certificate, what is parenthood, should we normalize the polycule and celebrate, you know, open non-monogamy. I mean, every single thing that had to do with marriage and family focused on validating adult sexual identity and sexual pursuits. And it was always the children who suffered. So Them Before Us says, if it has to do with marriage and family, we are first going to say children have a right to their mother and father. And then we are going to insist that everybody in the political and the personal space conform to those rights.
Absolutely. And I want to spend a lot of time talking about the last 10 years of Obergefell, but you know, the Supreme Court decision that legalized same-sex marriage. But before we get to that, I want to talk about the decades leading up to that, because you know, I think that you're on the same page with me on this. When I go to churches, many times I get comments like, oh, gay marriage, like, or the gays, they're ruining the sanctity of marriage. And like, yes, they've done a lot of damage, but heterosexuals have done a lot of damage to the sanctity of marriage over the last decades. And I'm the product of divorce and a no-fault divorce. And, you know, and so let's back up before we get to Obergefell. And what are all these issues that was really leading us to this spot that was just taking away the rights of you know, kids over the last several decades?
Good. Yeah, you absolutely need this measured deliberate setup, because things did not begin with normalizing same-sex relationships, even though that drastically altered the entire framework of marriage and parenthood law in a way that most people don't understand. And that's why I'm spearheading a national coalition to overturn gay marriage. It's called the Greater Than Campaign. You can go to greaterthancampaign.com and check it out. But it didn't begin there. Okay, so I talk about this in terms of there were three revolutions that took place to get us where we are today. Where are we today? We are in the place where children are regarded as accessories to adults. We used to believe that children were born into a pre-political relationship with their own mother and father, and that is what we called marriage and family. We are not there today. Now, in the cultural, legal, and technological space, we have made mothers and fathers optional, and we have regarded children as functional accessories or objects. So how did we get here? Well, there was a cultural revolution that took place in the 60s that liberated us from a lot of those outdated patriarchal understandings about sex being only for marriage, or that it should involve a man and woman, and that, you know, marriage was actually an institution. It was not just something that made adults happy. So those ideas started to permeate the culture. And then you moved into the legal space, where we normalized no-fault divorce starting in 1969. And that was the first redefinition of marriage, right? That is where we took these three characteristics of marriage that set it apart from other human relationships: permanence, complementarity, and monogamy. And we said, you don't need permanence anymore. It can last as long as you want. It can end when the adults are unhappy. Whereas previously we said, it can end. It can end when somebody's at fault of abuse, adultery, addiction, or abandonment. And that, in essence, communicated to society and to the legal space that this didn't need to be till death do us part. It really could last until the adults stopped being happy. Well, then gay marriage said, well, if this is not really about kids, and if it's just about adults being happy, being married to somebody of the opposite sex, of the same sex, makes me happy. So then we removed complementarity from marriage. And now in our neck of the woods, especially in Olympia, in Seattle, in Portland, there are municipal efforts moving towards removing monogamy as well, right? We want to normalize the thruple raising the child. We want to affirm these non-traditional familial homes. And so we've got to move to remove monogamy as well, because if it's not about kids and if it's just about adult fulfillment, some people are fulfilled by it being in a relationship with seven other adults. So the legal overhaul has been underway since the late 60s. But then we had the technological revolution as well. First, where we separated sex from babies through birth control. Then we separated babies from sex through IVF. And once we were making babies in a laboratory, it was just as easy to use somebody else's egg or sperm, and then finally, or womb, to manufacture a child. So now we have the cultural conditions that normalize mother and father loss. We have the legal conditions that make it easy to separate children from biological parents and reattach them to biological strangers. And we have the technological ability to sever a child's relationship with their mother or father at the moment of conception. So it is sort of the perfect storm that has led to the valorization of anything an adult wants as an unmitigated good, even a constitutional right, which in turn subjects children to the status of object. So there is a lot going on that led up to Obergefell. I would say Obergefell kind of has hit the peak in terms of the potency of reordering our domestic life around adult validation rather than the fundamental observable reality and needs of children.
Absolutely. Thank you. Let's talk about the aspect that biology matters in a parent-child relationship. And Obergefell obviously then was a big step in taking away the aspect of biology matters. And so, but we're seeing that already beforehand. So like with step-parent relationships, what were your observations, your research? What did that tell you about the fact that biology matters in a parent-child relationship?
This is so critical, and it actually is the foundational argument, not just for child protection, but understanding like what it is that the natural family, as God designed it to be, why it's plan A when it comes to child thriving. So first of all, like biology matters in the parent-child relationship for three reasons. Number one, we have studied family structure for decades. We have looked at step families. We have looked at cohabiting situations. We have looked at same-sex parented situations. We've looked at adoption. We've looked at donor conception. And we see that a child's own genetic mother and father are statistically the most connected to, invested in, and protective of them. So much so that when we look at other household structures, whenever the child is raised by an unrelated adult, rates of abuse and neglect skyrocket. That's not to say that all stepfathers or all stepmothers are abusive. Many of them are stepping into the gap left by a negligent biological parent. But on a population-wide level, it is demonstrable that genetic parents have a tighter, more protective connection with their child than unrelated adults do. This is exactly why adoptive parents like me have had to undergo screening and vetting, because we are actually a known danger to children when an unrelated adult is on site in the home. Risk of abuse, sexual, emotional, physical are off, you know, largely expanded. But even just neglect, unrelated adults do not pay as much attention to children, and so they suffer more accidental injury and death as well. So that biological connection, if we believe children should be safe and loved, we believe they should be raised by their married biological mother and father whenever possible. Number two, children get something from their biological parents they don't get from other adults, and that is their biological identity. It is very hard for children to answer the question, who am I, if they cannot answer the question, whose am I? That is why in America, we have swung drastically away from closed adoption, which was the norm in the 70s and the 80s, towards open adoption. Now, 95% of domestic adoptions are open, with some degree of knowledge and connection to and relationship with the child's first family, because the child needs answers that even loving heterosexual adoptive parents cannot offer them. And then the third is, if the child is raised by both biological parents, they get the perfect gender balance in the home 100% of the time. And children do not just need guardians or caregivers. They need a mother and they need a father. Men and women are different. Those differences manifest themselves in a variety of different expressions, but most profoundly in the home. Children need interaction with both halves of humanity. It maximizes their development. It satisfies their longing for male and female love, so they are not as hungry to find male love in unhealthy places, or female love from people that are not going to give it the way children are meant to receive it. And so that mother-father pairing is something that is non-negotiable in the life of a child. So when you can defend a child's right to their biological mother and father, you answer every question that we have about marriage and family. It gives you the right answer about the definition of marriage. It tells you divorce should be avoided unless the child is at risk or in danger. It tells you that nobody should be pursuing a third party to make a baby through reproductive technologies. It means no womb should be outsourced. It's always going to inflict a primal loss on a child. It means that a throuple or a serial monogamy situation after divorce puts children at risk, because it always includes unrelated adults sharing living spaces with child. Understanding that biology matters is one of the easiest ways to understand and have clarity about every question around marriage and family.
Absolutely. And I wanted to give this caveat, is that, so we're Christians. We believe that sometimes adoption is necessary, right? And it's an act of obedience. My wife and I, we have two young kids. We'd love to do foster care and adoption. Unfortunately, the state of Washington makes foster care really difficult right now for Christians, right? And so can you just explain the differences there between the adoption that is an act of obedience to take care of an orphan versus what the world is calling an adoption right now, which is actually creating a situation in which a child is taken from a parent? What are the differences there? Because they accuse us then of like being against adoption. And so what are the nuances, the caveats that we need to know there?
There is no nuance. I will tell you very clearly how to know whether or not you are obeying God and seeking to mend a wound that a child has experienced, or whether you are denying God and rejecting him and inflicting that wound. And the question is, who is doing the hard thing? In all of these marriage and family situations, infertility, a struggling marriage, experiencing same-sex attraction, unwanted singleness, somebody is going to do the hard thing in those situations. The question is, will it be the adult or will it be the child? Who is going to shoulder the load? Our culture has said, either there is no load. You can just leave your husband if you feel like he's not doing the 50% of the dishes that you want him to do, and it's no big deal, right? The kids will be happy if the adults are happy. The reality is that divorce inflicts lifelong loss on children. And whatever you fail to work through as a parent, you're saying, hey, kids, this burden is too heavy for me. You take it instead. It's the same thing with infertility. A lot of people that we know who would be incredible mothers and fathers cannot get pregnant sometimes because they have bad information and they've been told they have unexplained infertility when they really have unexplored infertility. Nobody's looked to see what the cause of that infertility is and worked to heal their body. But the solution to desperately wanting to be a biological mother is not to go to the sperm bank and separate a child from their biological father. Who's going to do the hard thing? Either the adults or the child who loses their mom or dad. In a situation where somebody would be an incredible father, but he experiences same-sex attraction, or an incredible mother, and she experiences same-sex attraction, somebody is going to do the hard thing. Either it will be the adult who sacrifices their romantic or sexual desires so the child can be raised by their mother and father, or the child loses their mother and father so the adult sexual attractions can be validated through the family. So what's happening in adoption is actually completely different from all of those things. The child has experienced loss. The child's parents can't or won't do the hard thing needed to raise them. So adoptive parents step in. They are not inflicting the wound through selfishness. They are seeking to mend the wound through self-sacrifice. Mm. In the world of, for example, big fertility, the child loses their mother or father, very often loses their life. Big fertility, IVF, is responsible for many times the number of death of embryonic children than Planned Parenthood is. So the child loses their life, loses often their mother or father or both, so adults can live as they please, so adults can have what they want. Reproductive technologies force children to do hard things for adults. In the world of adoption, it is the opposite. Adults do hard things on behalf of children. Yes. They subject themselves to screenings, vettings, background checks, home studies, references, post-placement report, monitoring. I mean, it is a situation where the adults are adopting hardship on behalf of the child. So if you're ever wondering, gosh, is it okay if we do this or this news item that just came up, just ask yourself, who's doing the hard thing? If the answer is the child, it's an injustice. If the answer is the adult, then that is something that we should support, encourage, and bless.
Absolutely. That is a great distinction, that actual adoption actually mends a broken situation as best as possible. And all these other ways that we're trying to co-opt the word adoption is actually causing harm to kids. It's actually creating the broken situation for kids. And that is a massive, massive night and day distinguishment. So let's get into Obergefell. You know, it changed so much. You know, it's been 10 years, actually almost 11 years now, since the Supreme Court made this decision. And we had a lot that led up to that, you know, with no-fault divorce, cohabitation, pornography everywhere. Society was already a mess, but this was a big, big step into codifying into law these ideals that put the desires of adults over the rights of children. And so what are some of the results we've actually seen from that?
Okay, so what is it that the Supreme Court required in Obergefell? They said, same-sex and opposite-sex couples have to be treated exactly the same. And if you don't, it's discriminatory. They're unequal. It's unconstitutional. So here is the problem. When it comes to their finances, maybe when it comes to the strength of their emotional feelings, maybe there's no difference. But there's a huge difference when it comes to children. What is that difference? A man and a woman make a baby. A man and a man do not make a baby. So in the world of parenting, if there was going to be no discrimination, that means that the law had to accomplish what biology prohibits, which is making two adults of the same sex parents of a child. That led to a total reordering of all of parenthood law. It meant that biology could no longer be a determining factor as it related to who is and is not a parent. Biology itself is now bigoted, right, in the Obergefell universe. It means that we cannot say that there is a mother and a father, because that's discriminatory. Some couples don't have a mom and a dad. And so we have expunged all of these gender-specific words from parenthood law. And because same-sex couples could not access children through the reproductive act, we actually had to create new opportunities for them to manufacture children through big fertility and then subsidize it through state support or through insurance companies, because it's discriminatory for heterosexuals to be able to get pregnant on their own, but they don't have a womb or a sperm or an egg between them. So what we've seen is a flattening and erasure of all distinctions of the natural family that there's two adults, that it's a man and a woman, that they have to have a biological or an adoptive connection. Those are the two legitimate ways to recognize parentage. And instead, we are now at the place where the only thing that makes a family, the only thing, the only criteria as it relates to determining that somebody is a parent is, did the adult get the exact product that they ordered at the marketplace? Mm-hmm. That yes. is it.
And that's really what it boils down to, is we're making children into a product in a marketplace.
Right. And that is driven by, it is not driven by, it is required by gay marriage. You can look at these 38 countries around the world that have legalized gay marriage. Zero. Have reinforced the idea that children need, belong to, and have a right to their mother and father. All of those countries have either eroded or eradicated the understanding that children need their mom and dad. It is incompatible to say, I support gay marriage. Children need their mother and father. You have to pick. One is going to get you a lot more cocktail dinner invitations. One is going to mean that you are going to sacrifice socially and relationally, but children are going to be protected. That is now the decision that we need to make. Are we going to continue to pretend like gay marriage just is about what happens in the privacy of your own bedroom? Or are we going to recognize that we have overhauled all of marriage and family to make mothers and fathers optional and regard children as functional accessories for their desires? So that's the place that we're at now. Obergefell had a radical impact on family law, and it is having a devastating impact on children.
Absolutely. And so you are going to battle for this issue, and I appreciate so much of what you're doing. Tell us about your Greater Than campaign that you have started to actually overturn the Obergefell ruling.
Well, it, like you said, it's been 10 years, and nobody's done anything. No organization has challenged this on the grounds of how it has harmed children. There have been a few attempts here and there to say, hey, we need some religious liberty protections. And there was an attempt by Kim Davis, who has been absolutely targeted by this gay couple for refusing to sign their marriage license. But that wasn't a real challenge. Nobody has actually tried to retake the most child-friendly institution the world has ever known from the clutches of the gay lobby that says we deserve this, regardless of the cost to children. So at Them Before Us, we are spearheading a coalition of about 100 different organizations, half of which are listed on the greaterthancampaign.com website. And you are going to see a pretty incredible assembly of educational institutions, media organizations, think tanks, influencers, religious leaders, who are all speaking with one voice. And we are saying, don't touch the kids. Don't touch the kids. Children need their mother and father. And you cannot legislate it away just because five Supreme Court justices decided that they've discovered a right to marry in the same sex in the Constitution. They haven't. They didn't. And children are suffering because we've pretended that. So what we are going to do at Greater Than is three things. We are going to enact a policy, a judicial strategy that is going to reassert the preeminence of the natural parent-child relationship. Say, this is not something that's negligible or optional. It is critical for children. We are going to insist that we once again say that children need their own mother and father in law. Number two, we need to change public opinion. It is not enough. I think we learned from the Dobbs decision. It's not enough to overturn bad Supreme Court precedents. We have to reshape the way people think and speak about marriage. Gay marriage was not just, it's not liberation for adults. You might want to think it that way, but it's actually bondage for kids. Gay marriage led to child victimization and natural marriage.
And it's bondage for adults too, right? like I've lived the lifestyle and in Romans 1, God gave them over to their depravity, and living it out is actually a consequence of our misplaced desires and our lust and the idolizing after people. And so, I deal with every day the consequences of people's sin and depravity, and the world was cheering them on. And we've taken away the guardrails and taking away the dam that's holding back people's desires from causing destruction, right? And we want people's desires to change, but through discipleship, through knowing Jesus. But at the same time, we need to, as a society, have still the dam there that's holding back the harm that people's desires are going to cause.
I totally agree. And not only have we taken away the guardrails, you know, we have when God talks about giving them over, my husband says, it's like the picture of you're in a river of sin and your boat is on the edge of the bank. And you're like, I really want to get in that water. And when God gives them over, he's like, oh, do you? Great. And he shoves the boat out in there. He's like, well, you want that? Go eat it, taste it, revel in it, wallow in it, hopefully so that you come back. But that's actually what the Supreme Court did, is it said, oh, we're going to shove you out into this. We're not just going to say that you can make consenting decisions. We're going to say this is a constitutional right. And you actually don't have dignity unless you can engage in same-sex marriage that is validated by the state. And so the problem with that is, of course, that it leads to child victimization. When the reality is natural marriage, whether you want to look at it from a sociological or a biblical perspective, is the best vehicle that we have for child protection. It is the best tool that nearly all societies, all religions throughout history has used to unite children to their mother and father, and therefore exempt them from so many of the physical, mental, emotional, academic, and relational harms that they would face outside of that union. There's a reason why God says that fatherless children deserve special protection. It is because fatherless children are vulnerable children. Yes. Vulnerable too many things and in so many ways. How do you keep them from being vulnerable? You reinforce the importance of men and women committing to one another before they have sex, staying together for life, and excluding all others. Like, that is the recipe for child thriving and child protection. So that is what we need to communicate in terms of changing public opinion. And then third, we need to turn the church into a child-centric fighting force. We need the church, Protestants, and Catholics to understand it's not enough to believe the right things about marriage. You must go into the public square and proclaim it so children are protected.
Yes. I know that we're getting close to being out of time. I want to talk about how can the piggybacking off that, how do everyday people go to battle? I feel like for one reason, it's so hard because everyday people have already made these decisions, right? They're being a step parent, and which is can be a wonderful thing, right? To fill a gap. But it's like, I know so many people who have already had a no-fault divorce and they're have step parents and blended families, or they, you know, not very many people I know use surrogacy, but I know people who got pregnant from a sperm bank because their biological clock was ticking and they really wanted a child. And I want them to have grace, right? And I want to love these people and I want them to know Jesus, but I also want them to go to battle. And how do we lovingly and truthfully at the same time, like, convince people that what we've been doing is wrong when they've been part of the problem, right? And we want them to rest in God's grace and to surrender to God's truth. And it's so hard when it feels like we're already so far gone and so many people in our lives and so many Christians have made their wrong choices here. And so now how do we go back on that? How do we get them to fight for this when it would be acknowledging that I have kids that I love dearly, but I've made the wrong choices for them.
Yeah. We need to do two things very, very well. We need to be gentle with people because very often they've got to that place because they were suffering or misguided or didn't have enough information. And they probably themselves have tasted the fruit of disobedience or stepping outside of God's design. We need to be founts of mercy for them. And we need to be the place where they can land, where they find empathy and compassion. But we have to be ruthless with ideas. We need to destroy any arguments that set themselves up against the knowledge of God. And one of the major ways that the knowledge of God is being distorted is in the area of marriage, family, and parenthood. It is a place where we have allowed the culture to inform us rather than an embodied vision of humanity based in the Imago Dei and fleshed out in the explicit commands of Scripture. And unfortunately, Christians often get that wrong. They are ruthless with the people in their life, and they're too silent or they're too gentle with arguments. You need to reverse that. And biblically, you don't have the option to do one or the other, and you do not have the ability to be ruthless with people and gentle with arguments. There is a biblical mandate here, and it is to mourn with those who mourn, rejoice with those who rejoice, and bear one another's burdens in the personal realm. But on matters of ideas, you give no quarter, not for the sake of compassion, not for the sake of nuance, not to try to win the more. Winning the more never involves bending God's truth. So I understand that the relational cost is high. The progressives have designed it that way. They want you to incur a social cost. They want you to experience relational isolation if you step out of line. And so there is something genuinely to be feared here. It is the fear of man. So you have to determine what you fear. Are you going to fear their response? Or will you fear disappointing the Lord who have said, I have given you, I've appointed you in this moment, this time, this place to be salt and light, to preserve and to illuminate. And that does come at a cost. Christ did not come to bring unity among all people in your spheres of influence. He came to bring a sword, a division, even within your own family. You know, Luther famously and wonderfully and succinctly said, unity when possible, truth at all costs. So you must be very serious. How do you speak the truth unless you know the truth? So first, I would say you should know more about this than anyone else. More about the impact of divorce, more about how donor-conceived children struggle, more about children who are raised in same-sex-headed households and the different confusions and challenges that they face. That is the point of our first book, Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights.
I have it right here, and we will do what we can promote this. I'll put a link in our show notes. It is amazing.
You will become an expert. No one will stand against you. And you need to take that information out into the world, not as a weapon against your friends who are suffering, but you do need to be the most informed so that when they say, I just kind of want to leave my marriage because, I don't know, we've just been like arguing for so long. Wouldn't it be better for the kids if we just separated? Or when somebody says, I really want to get pregnant, but it's just not happening right now. And, you know, my friend had gotten an egg donor and then I could have the experience of pregnancy. What's the harm? You need to have the answer for that. Not because you're going to charge in and be ruthless with people, but because those ideas have got to be torn down and destroyed. And you're the person that God put in their life to do that.
Yes. And so many times I have to work through this with families I minister to all the time who have, you know, gay, lesbian kids. Of the two easy routes are to become affirming because then there's no conflict, or to be ruthless and set the boundaries, push these people out of your life. And then there's also no conflict. You don't have to actually deal with them around your dinner table. And so those are the two easy routes, but it's like, we're called to love people and be truthful people. And we can do both at the same time. And that's this messy middle. That is the place where it takes being on your knees and having fruit of the Spirit and wisdom from above. I refer to James 3 a lot in ministry. Like, we don't have check boxes. We have wisdom from above that helps us apply difficult truth to hard relationships. And we should love people so deeply and bear their burdens with them that they will be willing, hopefully, to listen to some truth from us because they see that we actually care about them, but we're also going to fight the horrible ideas they've bought into.
Yeah, that's perfectly well said. Totally agree.
Katie, we are out of time. I want to make sure that people know about your book, Them Before Us. You also have another newer book that I haven't gotten to yet, but I really need it. It is Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City. It's like, gosh, I need that right now because I'm just outside Seattle here too. So tell us a little bit about that book.
I co-authored it with Stacey Manning again. We co-authored the first two books, and it was not because we have this ministry or anything like that. It's because I travel so much. And when people find out that I had read that I had raised four kids with my husband in Seattle and none of them had blue hair and none of them were like voting socialist, they're like, how did you do it? I don't understand. And my husband and I had been in youth ministry for years. We had seen parents do it wrong in terms of oversheltering or overexposure. And we honestly were very poor for a long time. So we didn't have money for like private school or, you know, so our kids largely went to public school. And also we were not afraid of them. Like, we were not afraid of the ideas. We wanted to make our children wise and keep them innocent. So Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City is just a book on how to instill your worldview in your children, even if you are one of the only sources of truth in their life, even if the schools are lying to them or their friends are lying to them and social media is lying, maybe you don't have extended family that's on the same page at all. How is it that you pass on your worldview to your children? And it specifically does that in age-appropriate stages. What should you be doing in elementary school, middle school, and high school. What topics do you need to be addressing that are specifically under attack that you need to shape their worldview on early and often? And lots of stories about our kids getting it right and us getting it wrong. So
awesome. Great resource. And then we'll also link the Them Before Us or the Greater Than campaign. So the Greater Than campaign is the coalition that you have started. And so we will link that in the show notes too.
Good. Thanks, Brady. Right. I really appreciate connecting with you.
Yes. We appreciate you so much. You're doing some remarkable work, and I will push all my people to check it out and support what you're doing. So thank you so much, everyone, for joining us on this episode of Calibrate Conversations. Make sure you check out calibrateministries.com for more resources. Appreciate it. If you like this video, share with your friends. Such an important conversation. Thank you for joining us.